Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Every Friday at 11 a.m., we're joined by Clay Travis. Outkick coverage, Fox Sports. Clay, Tennessee, Florida week. You are the betting man. Who are you taking?
So I got in on this one early. I loved the under. This line opened at 49 over-under. I feel like Felipe Franks and Jarrett Garantano are not very good. I don't think Tennessee can score very many points. I think Jeremy Pruitt's going to play a defensive, grounded-out style. I think one team's going to win something like 21-17 over the other one. I'm still not sure which direction I'm going to go in terms of actually picking a winner. I've gone back and forth a bunch of different times. But I absolutely love the under, and it opened at 49, and I'm just checking right now. It's all the way down to 44.5. So
yeah, that was high.
Obviously agreed.
That was definitely high. I'm surprised at that.
That was good of you to get in on that 49 number. I didn't know it opened that high.
Yeah, it opened on Monday at 49, and it's continued to come down all week. It's at 44.5 now. I think it could get down into the 43s by kickoff tomorrow. Look, I don't think Tennessee's very explosive offensively, but I do think they're going to be decent defensively. I think Felipe Franks is not very good. I don't think Florida's going to have a lot of success moving the ball against Tennessee either. And so I think this is going to come down to probably who makes a mistake, right? Does Felipe Franks throw a pick six? Does Tennessee have an unfortunate turnover, as has happened a lot of times in these Florida-Tennessee games? Somebody make a play on punt coverage, kick returns, special teams. I think it's just going to be one of those games where it's right in the gray area the whole way. And obviously, look, if Jeremy Pruitt could win this game, I think his 2018 season would be a phenomenal success through four games. If he loses, then I think people are going to say, man, this sucks, because now you got to go Georgia, Auburn, Alabama back to back to back and probably take three straight ass kickings. And then hope you could somehow run the table down the stretch, which I think will be a high rate of gold, because I think Missouri's pretty good. I think Vanderbilt's pretty good. And I think Kentucky's pretty good. So to me, this is massive for both teams. Similarly, look, if Dan Mullen loses to Florida, loses to Kentucky and Tennessee in the same year, man, that's a messy situation for a debut. I believe in Dan Mullen. I think he's going to be a good coach. But I don't know. It's been the 70s, I would bet, since Florida has lost to Tennessee and Kentucky in the same year.
So, Clay, in looking at this, we had this discussion earlier. Looking at the implications on the Tennessee-Florida rivalry, I said that it's important for Jeremy Pruitt and Tennessee to win this game because it lights a fire in this rivalry. And here's why. Dan Mullen chose Florida over Tennessee. He had a chance to go to both places.
Yeah.
If Florida goes in there and wins as the favorite, it's just ho-hum. Florida's much better than Tennessee. It's a better job. Dan Mullen made the right decision. But suddenly, if Jeremy Pruitt, this unknown, this guy who's never been a head coach, can beat the rival Florida in his first matchup with them, there's going to be a lot of questions about this rivalry moving forward, and probably some questions about Dan Mullen starting 0-2 against Kentucky and Tennessee in his tenure at Florida. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree. I mean, I think also, if you've been around Tennessee long enough, I think the odds of Tennessee going on the road and winning at Florida next year are low. I mean, frankly, I don't think Tennessee's going to be orders of magnitude better next year. I think Florida will be better. So you'd like to be able to protect your home field. And then if you lose next year, you're 1-1 and you're coming back home for a rubber match in year three. But yeah, look, I think Dan Mullen has more to lose here. I think Jeremy Pruitt has more to win. If that makes sense. I think in the back of their minds, Florida fans think we should beat Tennessee. I think Tennessee fans think, I hope we beat Florida. And I always think if you're hoping to beat somebody, you have more to gain than if you expect to beat somebody, because in your mind, you're already kind of assuming that you're going to win that game.
Clay, looking at the Vandy loss to Notre Dame a week ago, I came away from that performance very encouraged about Vandy moving forward. I also heard from some Vanderbilt fans that says, yeah, it's fine, but we're getting tired of playing the moral victory game, And it also felt like a really big-time missed opportunity for Vandy in a game where it looked like they were going to go down and win the football game at Notre Dame and get a true signature win for Derek Mason. What were your thoughts at the conclusion of that game from a Vanderbilt perspective?
I think Vandy should have won. I think on that day, if, you know, Vandy turned the ball over three times, Notre Dame did not turn the ball over at all. Vanderbilt spotted 16-point lead, fumbled the ball at the one-yard line going in, had a, you know, receiver, I think it was Blassing Game, had an easy touchdown from Kyle Shermer go right through his hands. That catch at the end of the game there from the wide receiver, whose name's escaping me right now, he makes that catch, and I think Vanderbilt goes in and scores there. I think Kyle Shermer's really good. But look, I mean, the end result is Vanderbilt lost to Notre Dame. Beating Notre Dame would have been great. It's not like it really is going to have any long-range significance in terms of how they're viewed in the SEC. I don't believe, because you're still going to get judged by how you do. Vanderbilt could beat Florida this year. Vanderbilt could beat Ole Miss this year. Vanderbilt could beat Arkansas this year. Vanderbilt can certainly beat Tennessee and Kentucky. I would rather win five games in the SEC, the five that I just rattled off right there. I don't think they're going to be able to beat Georgia. I don't think – we'll see what happens to South Carolina. They could win that one too. I'd rather have a winning record in the SEC if I were a Vanderbilt fan and I could choose. Would you rather have a guaranteed winning record in the SEC? You get to 5-3 in conference. Or would you rather beat Notre Dame? I'd rather get to 5-3 in conference because I think that's the long-range, more impactful statement. But I certainly understand why Vanderbilt fans would be frustrated and be like, man, it's always tough to lose a game that you think you could win. And it's not like Vanderbilt was in that game because they scooped and scored on a fumble or because they returned a kickoff for a touchdown. They were in that game because I think talent-wise, they were very similar to what Notre Dame has right now on that Saturday. And I thought they had every bit of a chance to win. It's why I thought the line opening at 14.5 was kind of crazy, to be honest.
Clay, there are some big matchups across the SEC this week and also some massive spreads. When did the middle of the SEC get closer to the bottom of the SEC than the top? And is it more about Alabama and Georgia or terrible management and leadership and foresight at the other programs?
Well, I mean, look at Texas A&M. They almost beat Clemson, and they are a 26-point underdog right now to Alabama. I don't think that's about Texas A&M not being good. I think it's about Alabama and Georgia being excellent. And I saw the numbers come out from the Vegas sports books. They have some of these proposed lines. And I believe the closest team in the entire country to Alabama was Ohio State, if I'm not mistaken. And I think maybe it was Clemson. I can't remember exactly. But either way, Alabama was a 9.5-point favorite on a neutral field over the second-best team in college football. So I think that's it's tough to argue that, that the rest of the SEC has fallen off. I think it's just that Alabama and maybe Georgia, we'll see this weekend what happens against Missouri, have taken their talent to an entirely different level that the rest of college football can't match, not just the SEC. I actually think the middle part of the SEC is a lot more likely to match it than the middle part of, say, the Big Ten is. Remember, the Big Ten lost 7 non-conference games this past weekend. I mean, Rutgers went on the road and lost by 41 to Kansas, and there were Kansas professors asking why they didn't disband the program after Kansas started off the season by losing at home to Nicholls State. So I tend to think it's just about the elevation of Alabama and maybe Georgia more so than it is about the descent of the middle-tier programs.
Clay, your various feuds are one of the more entertaining things to follow on social media every day. When I wake up, it's amazing to see someone else coming after you on Twitter. This past week, it was Deadspin with a hit piece on you, and I tweeted this. I always find it amusing when an organization bemoans another organization for legitimizing someone by then further legitimizing that person by writing a lengthy hit piece on them, doing the exact same thing that they hated the other organization did. Where does this go back with Deadspin? Take us to the beginning of this feud, and what did you think about the piece they wrote about you?
First of all, I haven't even read the whole piece. I've been so busy. I mean, I got tagged in it, and I saw the headline, and I saw my picture, and I'm like, well, I kind of have an idea where this is going. It was not going to be a Clay Travis deserves a Nobel Prize kind of piece. So I frankly haven't had time with it. And that's one of the things that, in general, I found, you know, like as my profile has increased, is a lot of that's just noise. I mean, I read the New Yorker piece because I was like, wow, I can't believe the New Yorker wrote several thousand words about me, and it's going to be in their most recent magazine that's going to come out and hit newsstands soon. And I had no idea that article was coming. And I was like, wow, you know, I mean, I've been a subscriber to the New Yorker. I mean, this is big time. Deadspin writing something negative is not really a surprise. I don't know what happened at Deadspin. When I was an editor there a decade ago, it was kind of a zany, irreverent, fun place where you would go hang out when you were bored at work. And then it became kind of this stultifying, like, my worldview is correct, and if you believe anything else, you are Hitler kind of place. And it's really amazing to think about what that universe has become. And look, I mean, I think that I bother them because I'm obviously very successful. I'm a former Deadspin employee, and I think that makes it all the more frustrating to the current Deadspin employees that somebody like me can have been there and gone on to great success, and those guys are all probably not able to barely afford to live in New York City off what Deadspin pays them. And they're trying, by the way, to sell that entire company. And I think that's because what we're in the era of, in my opinion, is creating people who really like, creating fans who really like what you do, right? I've got a new book coming out on Tuesday. Fingers crossed, I think it's going to be a New York Times bestseller, but it's going to open really close to there. It's going to sell more copies than anything that I've ever written. We might sell more copies in the first month of this new book than every book I've ever written combined so far in the last decade. So I have created, whether you like me or not, a huge audience of people who really like what I do. And I think there's a great deal of jealousy from people at Deadspin over that, because I think they think, why does Clay Travis have this audience? I mean, the answer is because I've been grinding my ass away for 15 years, writing, doing radio, doing TV, doing everything I can to get my arguments out to the largest possible audience. But the funniest thing to me, and you tagged me on this, so I saw it, was they're arguing like, oh, the New Yorker has no business legitimizing Clay Travis as if he has an audience. And that to me was funny. I mean, look, you don't have to like me at all. In fact, you can hate me. But I've got a national radio show that's on in 300 markets, satellite radio, millions of podcast downloads a month. I've got a national television show that debuted, and but we're 2 weeks into it. I think the growth rate is going to be really good there as sports gambling becomes more prominent. And I've got a book coming out Tuesday that may well debut on the New York Times bestseller list. Arguing that I'm not legitimate is maybe the most ridiculous thing I could hear, because if I don't meet the standard of legitimacy for Deadspin, who does? I mean, how many other people have a national television show, a national radio show, and a soon-to-be best-selling book out right now in the world of sports media? That, to me, is the funniest part of their attack that you tagged me in that I saw. You can agree or disagree with all of my opinions, right? But arguing, oh, Clay Travis isn't legitimate enough to pay attention to while writing thousands of words about how I'm not legitimate enough to pay attention to seems to just go completely off the irony meter and fall into downright farcical nature.
I can only imagine how this will set you ablaze, because it set us ablaze. Hugh Jackson just insistent on Baker Mayfield not getting any reps with the one. I understand with the ones. I understand wanting to ease a guy in to some degree, but you also have to have him ready, and you also have to give him an opportunity to beat you over the head with the obvious thing that he's your better option. Comes in yesterday and lights that team on fire, which leads you to think, hey, why wasn't he out there before?
Yeah. I mean, and to me, this is almost a fireable offense for Hugh Jackson, even more so than everything else he's already provided. It was self-evident, I think, even in the chemistry and body language of the Cleveland Browns, that they thought, hey, Baker Mayfield's coming in. We got a chance now. And I don't understand how you could ever end up in that situation where you watch these guys play for months and you think it's remotely similar. And I would love to know how the decision was made. Maybe Baker Mayfield is the worst practice player of all time, and Tyrod Taylor is the greatest practice player of all time. But just watching that game last night, the Browns were unwatchable on offense for the first half until Baker Mayfield came in. And then, I mean, the way he threw the ball, right? I mean, the velocity, the quick decision-making that he had, his ability to see what was going on in the field, and frankly, even what the Jets did. Maybe the Jets will go back and look at this tape and they'll say, hey, we should have kept blitzing. We should have kept coming after Baker Mayfield aggressively. I think they were more afraid of Mayfield than they were of what Tyrod Taylor could do. And maybe it's the ultimate in bad luck if you're the Jets. You played such good defense that you knocked the starting quarterback out of the game, which actually allowed the Browns to beat you. Because I think if Tyrod Taylor played the whole game, there's no way imaginable this would happen. It reminds me a little bit of last year, with what happened with Bill O'Brien and the Texans. Look, you got Tom Savage out there, and everybody's like, man, this offense is atrocious. You bring in Deshaun Watson, and it's like you flipped a switch and everything changed. I don't understand how head coaches who are paid millions of dollars to make decisions can be this bad about the most important decision they make.
Clay, Conor McGregor, he's having that big fight coming up next month, and he yesterday signed an eight-year agreement, or not eight-year, eight-fight agreement with the UFC. But from your perspective, what does Conor McGregor mean for ESPN in particular and their billion-dollar contract they have with the UFC right now?
Well, I saw where ESPN announced they had 1 million subscribers on their ESPN Plus service that just has launched about 5 or 6 months ago. So I think the UFC is obviously a big investment there, and they're hoping that UFC fans who are very maniacal in terms of the degree to which they follow the UFC will continue to invest in that product through ESPN Plus. And so I think Conor McGregor is massive to the UFC because he's a guy that makes me come off my wallet and pay for a fight. I will pay for the next Conor McGregor fight, even though it's happening in the fall during football season. If I'm at home, and I think I will be on a Saturday night, I'll stay up late to watch Conor McGregor fight because I don't have any idea what's going to happen. I think that's a superstar-driven business. I did the same thing for Ronda Rousey. I think the UFC needs major superstars to make me care about their sport. The NFL doesn't. You know, there are other sports, college football, frankly, doesn't. There are other sports that I like enough where I'll watch regardless of how talented the people are on the field or in the involved in the sport. For the UFC, I think they need Conor McGregor desperately because whether you love or hate him, he moves the needle and you have to pay attention to what happens to him.
Well, I mentioned the Deadspin thing earlier. Sports TV ratings on Twitter also has been going after you for the ratings of your new show on FS1. What do you think about that? I know they changed their Twitter handle name to reflect something negatively about you. And do you worry at all that when you spend a lot of time criticizing television ratings of other shows, that if your show doesn't rate well, that it'll backfire in some way?
Well, that ship has sailed, right? I mean, so it's not like I can go back in time and change any of the things that I've ever read or said or done before. So I'm not a person who spends a lot of time worrying about the past. What I would say about the television show going forward is the momentum's really good. Look, I mean, sports gambling is going to be a major seismic change in the way that sports is going to be impacted on television. And I think there are going to be lots of sports gambling shows. The way that I would describe to think about them in general is sports gambling shows may not have the same audience that general sports shows will, but it's a more profitable audience because gamblers are worth a lot more money. In other words, on this show that we're doing, or even on my radio show, we can charge higher rates to gambling advertisers if they know that they're going to reach gamblers than we can to Coca-Cola to try to sell soda to our audience, right? And so I think that one of the ways to look at this is early in fantasy, I'm sure there were a lot of people who, when fantasy shows would come on, they would throw up their hands and they'd be like, you know, 15 years ago, why does anybody put fantasy football shows on television? Why does anybody talk about it on the radio? Well, now it's pretty established that there's a massive audience for this. I think as every state starts to slowly legalize sports gambling, the audience of sports gamblers is going to continue to grow. I don't know how big the audiences will ever be, right? Because I don't know. We did, I think the best audience we've had so far I saw is 60 some odd thousand people watched our show. But if 60 some odd thousand people are watching who are gamblers, that's better than 200,000 people watching if only 30,000 of them are gamblers, right?